Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, I'm very pleased to have Brad Taylor joining us again today. He is the New York Times bestselling author of Hunter Killer, and he joined us about this time last year with Hunter Killer, and he's joining us today with his brand new book, American Traitor. So let me tell you a little about him, and then we'll bring him straight on. Brad Taylor is a lieutenant colonel retired. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army Infantry and Special Forces, including 8 years with the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, Delta, which of course is popularly known as Delta Force. He retired in 2010 after participating in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, as well as classified operations around the globe. His final military post was as assistant professor of military science at the Citadel. In fact, that's where he started writing. I remember that from last time we talked. Brad has written 14 New York Times bestsellers and is a security consultant on asymmetric threats for various agencies. And again, he's joining us today with his new book, American Traitor. Here's my guest, Brad Taylor. Brad Taylor, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's exactly a year since we last talked. And gosh, what a year. Who predicted 2020, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking today, of course, about your new book, American Traitor. It's the 15th novel, I think, in the Pike Logan, Jennifer Cahill series. It's got off to a great start, receiving rave reviews. I just want to share this with our listeners. Associated Press calls American Traitor a page-turning thriller. It says Taylor is one of today's premier authors writing about the world of special ops. So I'm wondering, did you think when you wrote your first book, your first Pike Logan novel, that it would lead to this stream of success with a long-term series like this?
Absolutely not. Nobody's more surprised than I was. In fact, if I'd have known how hard it is to get published, I never wouldn't have even attempted it.
There's a lot to be said for naivete, isn't there, I think, when you're first starting out on something?
Yeah, it was, lightning struck for me, and I've been incredibly blessed, and I never, ever thought that it would be, you know, 15 books in. I wouldn't have predicted that.
Yeah. So, I mean, with a world in such chaos as it is, why do you think people are still drawn to these thrillers of intrigue and more chaos?
Well, I think everybody likes it. I mean, when you talk about thrillers, it's really just the storyline itself. Everybody likes a good character. Everybody likes to identify with a character in the series themselves. And, people live vicariously through, whether it's murder mysteries, thrillers, romance novels, whatever, they want to live vicariously through the characters. That's what makes this series work.
That's right. And at the end of the day, it's fiction, so we all need that escapism. So we're talking about American Traitor. I don't want to give away any spoilers here, but would you share a synopsis of the story so that listeners know what we're talking about today?
Yeah, it's basically about the threat of hegemon of China, basically. I actually came out, it's been kind of a slow burn for the book. 3 years ago, I was doing research for Operator Down in Lesotho, Africa, and that was about a coup, and so I had to see the parliament buildings and things like that. And when I went to see the parliament buildings, they were all brand new. I mean, really nice construction, and outside of it, there was a bunch of Chinese lettering, and which I assume said something like, you know, wear hard hat past this point. And so I asked the guy I was with, you know, what's up with the Chinese lettering? And they said, oh, China's building this for us. I said, what for? And they said, oh, they just want to be nice. And I was like, I don't think so. And that was my first bump into the Belt and Road Initiative that China's got going around all over the world. And they just kept bubbling up in the news over and over and over again with the things they were doing with espionage, with the Belt and Road, with Spratly Islands, with everything. And so I decided to write a story about it.
Just explain a little what that project's about, if you would, because I've heard snippets of it as well, and you do talk about that a little at the back of the book.
They call it the Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically, I mean, if I was going to be uncharitable, I would say it's basically a loan shark operation, where they go into a country and they develop port infrastructure, they develop, you know, the parliament buildings, they give a ton of money, cheap loans, and then when you can't pay the loan back, they call it in and they use it. And they use it, it's kind of a hybrid war, a gray war, where there's no bullets being fired. For instance, Taiwan, which is the focus of American Trader, they have about 15 countries left that still view them as a diplomatic entity. Well, China wants to stop that China wants to take over Taiwan. So what do? They do the Belt and Road Initiative into some Caribbean countries, and they give them a ton of money. And then in exchange, that country says, we no longer recognize Taiwan. It's insidious, but it's real.
Right, right. And so going back to American Traitor, your story, the premise there is, what if Taiwan could be manipulated or tricked into believing that China was mounting a full-scale invasion of them, and then they come in and attack? So that's really where the premise starts, you say. And I know that the location... you said was sparked. Your wife's been pushing you to go write something in Australia, but that wasn't enough. You had to have more storyline around it. And she's a master diver, I understand.
Yeah, so she kept saying, we got to go to Australia so I can dive the Great Barrier Reef. Well, I never had a plot line for Australia. And this plot line came out, was basically about Taiwan, and I was going to Taiwan. And I started, that stretched into Australia. I started doing research in Australia and the influence that China has in Australia, which is immense. And there was enough stuff going on in Australia with China that I was like, looks like you get to dive the reef.
And did she get to dive? Because I've heard they have a lot of restrictions out there because of pollution and the ecology there.
No, they have tons of, I mean, there's bazillions of different dive boats that go out to the reef to dive.
Yeah.
Up in, by Cannes, we went up to Cannes and she got on a boat and went out and dove.
Okay, good. So she fulfilled her dream and you got another book into the bargain there. So what has writing been like for you in 2020? I understand you did your research. Last time we talked, which was January of last year, you said you'd just got back from Australia and Taiwan. So you were out there doing your research, and then, of course, COVID hit. And you said in an interview, I think it was, or in the book, at the back of the book, you said that you had to reconsider your storyline, your timeline for this book. How did that work?
Yeah, because usually when I'm, you know, I do the research and then I get, you know, I'm on the ground, do all the research I'm going to do, and then I set the book basically when it's going to be released, which is, you know, yesterday the book got released. So I'll just, it's kind of jump forward, you know, 8 or 9 months. And I came home, started writing the book, and then COVID hit and everything got locked down. And then I was like, how do I put that in a book? Because all my research didn't matter. I was in the Shinland Night Market, which was just jam-packed with people on their Independence Day. Thousands of people, you know, a mass of humanity. Well, I'm sure they're not doing that now. Pike does surveillance operations in Sydney. Well, Sydney got locked down. I mean, that would be, the only people in the street would be the target in Pike. The planes can't fly anymore. You're not jet-setting around the world. And so it caused a lot of turmoil, me trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to deal with this? How do I predict what's going to happen, what's not going to happen? And I decided to set it right at the Taiwanese elections in 2020. January 2020, and that's what I did.
Yeah, because of course that's always a consideration when you're writing about anything that's time driven or technology, because it advances so quickly. Often by the time the book comes out, that technology is being replaced, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, with the pandemic was probably the worst of it, because you can't predict the twists and turns that are happening.
Yeah. And so there were other factors that went into developing this story for you. One of them, you say, was that the loss of an F-35 strike fighter off the Sea of Japan that happened. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, that's true. The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is our fifth-generation fighter, which is, it's the best aircraft in the world right now. And it's built all over the world. It's built... in Australia, and it's built in Japan. And they have a fabrication facility in Japan, and they built their own planes. It was a Japanese aircraft, and it flew into the ocean at 600 knots. I mean, straight in, bam, and broke up and obviously killed the pilot. And to this day, nobody knows why that happened. So I use that literally licensed in my book. I can tell you why it happened if you read my book. But in reality, that's a true thing that happened, and they don't know what caused it to do it. What it did do is shut down the production facility in Japan. They're all men in Fort Worth now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a true story.
Mm-hmm. And then going back to the China theme, another fact in your story is that China's president has said publicly that he won't leave the Taiwan question for another generation to resolve. He wants that resolved in his lifetime.
Yeah.
So what considerations did you take into that? And what, tell us how you wove these factors and these ideas into the story.
Yeah, he's basically turned himself into a dictator for life. And he has said, I'm not going to turn this over to the next generation. And he's got a serious problem. Taiwan's a thorn in the side of China, because he can do the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, which every country gets, you know, 12 nautical miles off their coast is their international waters. Well, you build an island, and then you've got another 12 miles. But he's got a problem because he's got Taiwan right in the middle of that. The Taiwan Straits are still freedom of navigation. We actually do what we call FONOPS, freedom of navigation exercises through the Taiwan Strait. And they have to get rid of Taiwan if they want to take over everything else. And he has said he's going to do that, and he is hell-bent on doing it. His problem is that nobody in Taiwan wants to be part of China, especially after they saw what happened in Hong Kong. And this is real world, and it plays out in the book, but real world, they looked at what happened in Hong Kong and said that's this whole thing about one state, two systems was a lie. It's not working out, and we want nothing to do with China. So he's got to figure out a way to do it. And I tried to figure out, put myself in his shoes and say, if I was going to do this, how would I do it, giving these parameters?
Right. Now, I know with Hong Kong, the British, we leased that for, I think it was 99 years, right? And then the lease came up and China took it back. But is Taiwan not a separate country by itself?
No, not technically. I mean, it depends on what you mean by country. Because
and who you talk to,
recognize them. I mean, in 1979, we recognized Beijing as the rightful heir of China. And we don't even have a treaty with Taiwan. We have what's known as a reciprocal defense agreement, which we said we will provide you defensive systems. Even when I was in second lieutenant in the Army, I went to officer basic course. We had Taiwanese officers that come through the course. When they graduated, they had to wear a coat and tie. They weren't allowed to wear the Taiwan uniform because we didn't recognize Taiwan. It's just an odd thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, interesting. So typically when we set out to research something, we're looking to learn about something in particular. And then that can, of course, lead us down many rabbit holes and trails. When you were doing your research for the story, and it sounds like you did this all ahead of time, what surprised you the most?
I think what surprised me the most, believe it or not, was the fact that Taiwan actually has its own culture. So when the Kuomintang, when Chiang Kai-shek fled China back in 1949 and went to Taiwan, the people in Taiwan looked at him as an interloper. And so there's a three-tiered system. It doesn't play out in the book at all, but I thought it was fascinating. There's kind of a three-tiered system. There's like, I'm from Taiwan, but I used to be from China. And then there's people from Taiwan who are like, these guys are all interlopers. It's kind of a layered thing.
Yeah, very complicated. And you say in the book that almost everyone under the age of 60 in Taiwan adopts a Western name. And I know I've run into folks from Taiwan with names like Anna and John. I figured they just did it to make it simpler. But is that true that almost everyone in Taiwan under the age of 60 adopts a Western name?
It is. I was lucky. I had a friend of mine who dealt with international business in Taiwan who hooked me up with a guy named Paul, who's in the book. I put it, Paul in the book is named after a guy that helped me out. And they, so he was real helpful for me for doing the research. And he said that people would either choose a name based on the phonetic spelling that sounded like an American name or an English name, or they just picked a name. And in his case, he just picked a name. He picked Paul.
Okay.
That was
interesting. Interesting. All right. So you mentioned this guy who helped you named Paul. He was much more than just a guy. He's like your twin brother, I read. Is that right?
Well, no. I have a twin brother.
And oh, okay.
I got in contact with him. So my twin brother was doing business in Taiwan and gave me his name.
Oh, okay. I got it. See, I must have skip read that bit. So when you're writing fiction, how do you decide at what point you need to stop taking creative liberties? Where do you take them most and why?
There's no point. There's no cut line for me to take liberties. It all depends on where I'm going with the story. And usually the liberties are, I'll never take liberties in something that's ironclad, you know, I'm not going to say gravity goes up instead of going down type stuff.
Right, right.
But for instance, there's a hit that happens in the Man Ice in Australia. The stairwell that goes down there does exist, the house does exist. The breach point does not exist. So I had to figure out a way to get in that house, and I decided, well, I'll just make a breach point there.
Yeah.
And so I did.
Right, good. All this great background you have comes in handy. And so can we talk about some of the locations? Because you have some great locations in here. And one of them wasn't even supposed to be in the book, Brisbane, you said. Tell us about
that.
Yeah. How did
that one? So I flew from Taiwan to, my wife says I'm geographically challenged, which is true. So I said, you know, we got to go to Taiwan, then we're going to Australia. And she said, you know, that's like a 9-hour flight, right? They're not next to each other. Just make it happen. So we flew from Taiwan to, we landed in Brisbane. We were supposed to go up to Cairns for the next leg of the research. And as we were taking off, the plane went up in the air and hit the ground, And I was like, this plane's broken. And sure enough, we pulled into the airport again and then spent, you know, 9 hours waiting on the plane to get fixed, which it didn't. And then they put us in a hotel, which was a really fancy hotel, which was fine with me. So we went to the hotel, went out and had dinner, went on the river walk, and I was like, there's enough stuff in here. I could put this in a book. So I did.
Right, right. And so what, did you have a favorite place on those travels? I mean, how long were you traveling and how many spots did you go to?
Well, when I do the book research tours, the sad thing about book research tours is I have to hit the ground running and do the research and get out. So I don't really get a chance to spend a lot of time doing something. And so, for instance, in Cairns, that was my research in Cairns was Elaine's time to go dive the reef, which I spent running all over Cairns, the houses that are in Cairns, everything that's in that in the book I've physically seen, put boots on the ground at. And I always regret not spending more time in a place that I should have. For instance, Hunter Killer, my last book, we went all over Brazil. And I probably spent 3 days in Rio, but I never saw really Rio because I was doing research the whole time. Never got to really get anything on the ground.
Right.
And so this, I think the best part would be for this trip would be Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had 2 days there where I could actually go to a beer hall and just get some food. The same beer hall's in the book, by the way.
And so you travel a lot for all of your books. You will do internet research, but you know, you actually like to get on a plane and go places. Is there a favorite place in the world that you've been to during your research days?
If I'd say it was for Daughter of War, it would be Switzerland.
Oh, and why did you like Switzerland so much?
It's just a gorgeous place, and the people are so nice, and I wish I could have spent more time there.
Isn't it clean there? Don't you think it's like so clean there? It's beautiful.
Yeah, there was. We went to the top of a mountain. There you have a restaurant that's up there, and you take a cable car to get up there, and the view was literally took my breath away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a guy that really gets emotional about views. And when I was like, this is incredible.
Mm. And so normally how long do you spend on doing your research? I've talked with James Rowlands a few times, and he always says he allows himself 6 months to do his research because he'd just do it indefinitely if he didn't cut off at some point. But how does that work for you?
Yeah, well, it's kind of an ongoing thing with me. So I'm doing, I'll do the research, for instance, this book, American Trader. I start off by reading, I probably read 6 books on the Ministry of State Security in China, the Chinese intelligence system, various geopolitical things, the artificial intelligence. There's a book, AI Superpowers, I read, just to get a feel for what's going on. And then I, in my head, I can start saying, here's how I'm going to start wickering the story. And then I'll go on the ground to do on-the-ground research, which is running around Taiwan and Australia. But it's a continual process. So even when I'm writing the book, I'll have to, something will pick in my head, and I'll be like, well, let me go look that up. For instance, I use the Roomba robot in the book, Internet of Things, that they're going to use to crack a house.
Right.
Well, I have to do some research on that. How does that work? How's, you know, it goes this way, goes that way. Let me figure out how I can crack that nut. So the research is, for me, it goes, there's no end point. As I'm writing the book, I'm still doing research.
Right, right. I would imagine, that's kind of how I work. I can't imagine just doing it and cutting off completely because things come up as you're writing. And and things change too. So let's talk about character growth, because we talked about this last time. I asked you how you keep your protagonists, Pike Logan and Jennifer Cahill, how you keep them fresh and evolving. And you said that's one of the most difficult but most critical things to make sure you do. So without giving away any spoilers, how would you say Pike Logan and Jennifer Cahill have grown over the last 2 books?
They're definitely still growing, I'll put it that way. So, well, I mean, I'll give a spoiler away. So they're getting married.
Yeah.
That's for growth.
I didn't think you'd go there.
Well, it's been talked about for 2 books.
Okay.
So the and Pike's still learning his way as being a Cro-Magnon, and Jennifer is growing kind of in the opposite direction. She's learning that the world is not black and white. There is some gray to it, and she's learning to live with that.
Right. And do you find there are particular scenes that are that you enjoy more writing, more that come more naturally, maybe, and scenes that are more difficult for you? And what are they?
Yeah, actually, the scenes that cause me the most trouble are, in fact, the Pike and Jennifer interactions. But they're also the ones that I enjoy the most. I'll rewrite those things 1,000 times, trying to make sure I get this thing right. The easiest things to write for me are what I used to do in my real job, assault scenes, you know, gunfights and things like that. I can write that, you know, without any trouble whatsoever. And the hard part about that is making sure that what I've written is something that the reader who doesn't have the knowledge I do will read and understand what's going on. And sometimes it gets complex. For instance, there's a scene where Duncan's being chased in on the rocks in Sydney, and there's 3 different POVs going on. You got the Chinese, you got him, and you've got Pike. Now, what I want is the reader to be, I don't want the reader looking at a car crash and seeing the car's wreck. I want the reader to be in the car when it wrecks.
Right.
And that's kind of difficult to achieve. That requires a lot of rewriting to make sure that the pace is there and the reader understands what's going on, but is not inundated with enough detail that he's just bored with it all. And so that takes a lot of work.
Right. I hope novice writers heard you say that, Brad, because you've said it a couple of times talking about this, how you have to write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. Because
yeah.
I run into people all the time who are like, think, you know, oh, I never have to rewrite my stuff. And I'm like, well, shoot, I'm a nonfiction writer. I have to rewrite my stuff all the time, you know.
Well, I'll tell you that every book's got one of these, every single book I've written. I can write 12 pages, 15 pages, don't touch it, maybe change a comma here or there, and then I'll write one paragraph that I've rewritten 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Until I can absolutely make sure this is it. This is what I wanted to evoke in the reader.
Right.
And that's the hard part.
And tell me how you approach dialogue. You have a lot of dialogue in your book, and it's good. It works. I say this all the time. If dialogue doesn't work in a book, it stops the whole story. But you're really practiced at this, really good at it. How do you approach dialogue?
I actually approach dialogue just, I think about what would happen in the real world when I'm on a team, when I'm talking on the radio, when I'm doing operations. What I don't like in dialogue is I don't want to spoon feed the reader. So in dialogue, it's how these people would actually talk. And sometimes that may go over the head of the reader, but then in the descriptions, they'll figure out what they're talking about. I don't want to spoon feed the reader with, hello, my name is Pike Logan, I'm 6'5", and here's what I look like, you know,
yeah,
type stuff. It's what they would actually say. So I think to myself, if I walked in a room right now and started talking at this, you know, Oversight Council meeting in the White House, what would I say? Would I give a big soliloquy, or would I just say something? And that's how I approach it.
Right. And having spent 20 years in the military, and I remember from last time we chatted that you said, you know, your job was something that you had to really every day prove yourself to keep your job. You know, it was like proving yourself over and over again just to keep the job. It's you're working at a very high level there. Does discipline now stay with you? Is that naturally ingrained in you now?
No, it's slowly but surely dripping away.
Oh.
COVID, my wife looked at me and says, you know, you got a book due. Can you get off the couch and start typing? I mean, I have the discipline to write when I need to, but it's not nearly as what it used to be, I'll tell you that. I was doing 2 books a year. I mean, that's discipline. You got to bang that stuff. That's 2 book tours, 2 books, 2 book research trips in a year. And so I really had to have discipline for that. Now it's kind of like, I got all the time in the world. I'll sit here and watch the soap opera.
Right. So what you're doing, like 1 a year now?
Yeah, 1 a year.
Yeah, and because when you're doing two a year or more, as you said, you're kind of writing one, you're maybe editing something else, you're marketing something else, and maybe
exactly
plotting your next one that's coming up. So
and yeah, I was writing short stories too, novellas. That I mean, it was all in there. It was crushing.
Yeah, you've written how many short stories have you written on your website? I know I counted the novels, but not the short stories.
I think 10. I'm not sure. I have to go count.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be fair, I mean, everybody I have talked with, even super successful people, have had trouble focusing and concentrating this year. But when I was reading the acknowledgements in your book, you weren't even allowed to let slide on your deadline here, right?
No, COVID was horrible for me. I mean, you'd think that that'd be the best solution ever for a writer. I'm locked in my house. I can't do anything. Instead, it was, I'm locked in my house. I can't do anything.
Yeah,
I couldn't concentrate. I had, you know, the kids came home from school. It was just a mess.
Yeah, and I think many people have felt that same way. It's like, oh, great, I can finally finish this project, and here it is still sitting there like 10 months later. Whatever. So I know you were born in Japan, but you grew up in Texas, in 40 acres in rural Texas. How do you think that shaped or influenced you?
Well, I guess the main reason it shaped my insights was that that's why I went in the Army. So, I mean, I had no intention of going in the Army. That was a complete fluke. I was flunking out of school. I was at the University of Texas, and I was a horrible student. And my dad said, you know, if you flunk out of school, you're going in the Army. And at that time, that was kind of like, what? Only losers go in the Army. I had no idea about the Army.
Mm.
And so I was convinced I was flunking out, so I started doing research on the Army to see where I was going to go. And I found special forces, I found Ranger battalions, that kind of thing. And I was like, that's not too bad. I mean, you jump out of airplanes and carry a gun. I grew up in the woods. I used to hunt all the time. Sounds like kind of my kind of life.
Yeah.
And as fate would have it, I did not flunk out of school. And so the next year, I call my second freshman year, I joined ROTC and went in the Army.
Mm. And, you know, having spent 20 years in there, it's not just a job, it's a way of life. Did that? I'm imagining that would take an awful adjustment coming back and being a civilian.
Yeah, not, I mean, I can't talk too much about it, but the unit I was in there left was a pretty classified unit, and you're kind of acting like a civilian while you're in that unit. I didn't wear a uniform, you know, I had long hair, beard and all that, so mm-hmm. It wasn't. The regiment that when I initially joined the Army, when you're in the infantry and you're showing up at 5 a.m. for physical training and checking your beard or checking your shave and all that kind of stuff, making sure your uniform's struck, to the time I left the Army, which was show up in whatever the hell you want to wear, and you might have a mission, you might not. So it was kind of a transition. It wasn't as great as you would think.
Right. So I have a couple of few words I just want to throw out at you and get your initial response to them. Tell me what discipline means to you.
Discipline means being able to control your own emotions, control your own actions, control your own destiny. To me, that's what discipline is.
I like that. How about creativity? What does that mean to you?
Creativity is, that's a hard one, because it's your own innate ability to use your imagination to create a different world, basically.
Okay. And how about spontaneity? What does spontaneity mean to you?
My wife would say that would be clean the dishes. Spontaneity is just, I mean, for me, it's seeing something right at the moment and seizing that moment at the time, not letting it pass you by.
Right. And now, I mean, you've had a couple of different careers now at this point, Brad. How do you define success? What does success mean to you?
Success to me is an ongoing process. I don't think I ever... I actually didn't call myself a writer until I had 7 books in, because I was embarrassed to say it. So success is always it's a ring that's always further out than I've touched.
Awesome. I like that. Something always to stretch for and look for. Well, Brad Taylor, it's always interesting talking with you. And I know listeners can find out much more about American Traitor, which is a book we're sharing today, at your website, as well as your other work. Your website is bradtaylorbooks.com. Final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Brad?
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. And then actually, if they go to the website, I have excerpts of every single book I've written. They can get a taste of any of the books right there.
Very cool. BradTaylorBooks.com. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Question or feedback on today's show, you can reach me through our website at conversationslive.net. Until next week, be safe out there and stay healthy.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.